what triggered this bizarre behavior.
Journey into the cold heart of Northern Darkness with Nordic Crimes.
That case became like a scene from a horror movie.
A new true crime documentary series that chilled the bone.
The hunger for killing is increasing in the course of these homicides.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Nordic Crimes is a part of the Acast family.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Just before we get into today's episode, I want to remind everybody that there will be colourful language from the start and throughout, as well as discussions around topics that some people may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised.
So I was in, there's a fight here inside the prison right now. You can hear it, maybe. And so, anyway.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Today is part 3, and the final part of the Wild Bill prison story. The man serving a 46-year prison sentence in Panama for what he says were crimes he committed as a killer for hire. Now a prison chaplain, Bill says the man he is today is a far cry from the selfish and moralist man he once was. In our previous episode, Bill had been transferred to the David Public Prison, located 400 miles away from Panama City. It wouldn't take long for him to find his feet inside the facility, seeing as the prison he was in was run by what he says is an extremely corrupt prison warden. He would begin by purchasing himself a comfortable spot to call home.
I bought a cell. When I say I bought it, I purchased it from Ismael Flores for $600. I gave Ismael Flores $600 and bought a cell. I immediately put direct TV, air conditioning, and tile on the floor. It was supposed to be a cell, a punishment cell, but I purchased it. I purchased the key to that cell from the guards for $100, so I could come and go at any hour of the day I wanted to in and out of my cell. This was in 2011, and I lived that way until 2017. Inside that cell, I lived alone. I didn't want anybody else there with me because I enjoyed my privacy. I would leave in the morning and come back in the evening. I would drink booze, like I would buy good vodka, Finlandia vodka, and bring it in with the guards and sit around and drink with them at night. We'd sit around and drink booze at night.
Once settled in the prison, Bill would seek to gain some sort of control in which he could get a bigger status within the facility as well as make himself a comfortable living. And he would see his opportunity hidden among the violence inside the prison. Yet he wouldn't be partaking in it. In fact, it would be the complete opposite. He would look to eradicate it.
The kids there were killing each other. This is a prison that has about 850 people in it when I got there. And the inmates were murdering each other with a regular basis. And the reason why is because there were 9 dominant gangs on the inside of the prison. There were street gangs on the outside. But when they get put in prison, they just group back together in the same street gangs. You can imagine how that works. And so they fight over who gets to sell cocaine, who gets to sell guns, who gets to do this, who gets to do that. So what I did is I went to the authorities myself and I said, I offer you a peace I'm sick of them searching because they're searching. I'm losing phones. Every time they search, we're like locked down for a week or two after the search. I mean, it sucks. I want to straighten that shit out so that I can live better. And I said, I want you to let me have a meeting with the 9 heads of the gangs. And they said, you're insane. They'll kill each other in a room. And I said, no, they won't. Give me the opportunity. So I took a room with no guards at all and brought in the 9 heads and sat down. And I said, listen, you bunch of idiots are killing each other. I didn't say it like that. I said, hey, you guys are killing each other. We got to stop the violence because you guys got to stop killing each other because you can't make any money. You guys are businesses. Street gangs are businesses. And in order to have prosperity, we need a cash flow. And there can't be any cash flow while you're killing each other because every time you kill somebody, they bring cops in here to search and shit, you know. So I said, this is how we'll do it. Let's split up the gangs and split up the territory on the inside. In this cell block, in this territory, this gang has the power. In this one, that gang has the power, and everybody agreed. So we literally drew up a peace compact and signed it. That came out in the news media as well, me standing there holding a peace compact. Wild Bill brings peace to the prison. But nobody understood that what I was actually doing was organizing the gangs into territories. What worked out great is if you want to sell drugs on the inside, or you want to bring in guns on the inside, or you want to do whatever on the inside, I don't sell drugs, but I'll sell you a license to sell drugs. If you don't buy your license from me, I'll send the cops to search you every fucking day. I'll make your life a living hell. But for the simple low fee of about $100 a month, what I will do for you is I'll advise you before any search. I'll make sure that your cell stays cold, that you don't ever get heated up. Nobody rats on you. If you need anything, you come directly to me, and I'll go straight to the authorities and make sure it happens. And everybody went for it. I was making about $4,000 a month on the inside of a Panamanian prison, and that may not be like a huge figure to you on the outside, but back in those days, in Panamanian prison, I lived like a king. That was a king's ransom, and I lived that way for about 7 years.
While undertaking his new role within the prison and maintaining order between the gangs, Bill would also facilitate the different religious groups and their attendance at the facility. With so many nationalities and groups inside, there are many different faiths that would conduct services for the inmates, and Bill created a type of roster for them all. Bill would spend more and more of his time with the faith leaders and religious leaders who came to the prison, and he said it would start to have a profound effect on him.
When you start surrounding yourself with something, you become that thing. I don't know if you understand what I mean, but I surrounded myself on Thursdays with the church, and I became really involved with the church and really loved the church. I enjoyed Thursdays. I took Thursday off. I took Thursday off from being a gangster. Literally, like, that was my gangster day off.
So Thursdays were, as Bill calls it, his days off from being a gangster. Yet he hadn't quite shaken his old ways just yet. He says that drugs and guns are rife within the prisons of Panama and explains just how they're able to be brought in.
The drug trade is huge inside the Panamanian prison. How does that work? Well, let's say the cops bust some Colombian drug runners and they get 100 kilograms. They report 80 and they take 20 kilograms and they bring them to the prison. They give them to the street gangs that are on the inside here, and they give them guns as well to protect the cocaine that they're floating on the shore. So they give the white, kilograms of the white, to the drug cartels on the inside, and then the drug cartels sell the dope. Then the cops come back in 2 weeks with more cocaine, and then to get paid. And the cycle goes on and on and on and on. So the guns come in with the cops, the cocaine comes in with the cops. And the cops try to say that it's the family members in the visit that are smuggling that shit in. But I ask you, listeners, have you ever seen a woman that can fit an AK-47 in her or her? How about a kilogram, a square one-foot block of cocaine? You know, that's not happening. The guns and the drugs come in from the officials that run the prisons. That's just how it is on the inside here. It's dangerous to even talk about it, but I'm to the point now where I'm in my life that I don't know how much longer I'm going to be alive. So the story and the reality of what's happening down here has to be told.
Another common occurrence within prisons everywhere, but Bill says especially where he's incarcerated, is death. He says prisons in Panama can be especially hard for foreigners, and remembers one American man who would lose his life at the David public prison back in 2011.
An American guy who was very emotionally and mentally unstable came to prison there because of this. He had an ultralight airplane, and he bought like 10 kilograms of cocaine and was going to traffic it back to the United States in this ultralight, you know, flitherer type airplane, this little bitty thing. So he crashes, like literally crashes into a border guard station. So obviously he comes to prison because he's got like 10 kilograms of cocaine, but he didn't do good on the inside. He didn't do very well. They beat him up and treated him bad. And so he climbed up on top of the guard tower, called the news media. The news media came and he dove headfirst off the guard tower. And that was like the week that I got there in 2011, the first week in 2011.
Michael Nadella was a 48-year-old American national who would indeed take his own life at the David Public Prison. The prison and its director, Ismael Flores, declined to give the media their version of events from that day. But of course, it's not just foreigners who lose their life in prisons. And with the drug trade being so huge in that part of the world, there are inevitably a lot of deaths that go with it.
There was a guy named, I believe his last name was Polanco. And Polanco got brought in for smuggling kilograms of cocaine, but he was what they call a tumbador. A tumbador is a guy who robs other drug smugglers. Like, he'll get a group of four or five gangsters together, they'll be armed, and as you're trafficking drugs, he'll attack you, kill you, and take your drugs. There's a lot of that goes on here, a lot of it. He was one of them, and he robbed the wrong guy. Anyway, so they brought him to prison and stuck him in this very minimum security area, and he knew that he wasn't going to last for long. He even told everybody, I think they're going to kill me. So they called Omar Cañon, who's dead now, who died like about 6 months ago. He was murdered in Costa Rica. Omar Cañon was the head of a gang called the Cañones. So Omar Cañon, they called Omar Cañon and told him they'd pay him $25,000 to kill him. So here's what they did. The cells were divided by concrete block walls that are filled full of concrete and poured full. But the ceilings of the cells were just double-walled zinc roofing, just like metal roofing, not very secure at all, actually. So what they did is they just took a pair of tin snips and cut a hole in the roof and then cut a hole back down. So they cut a hole in one side, they cut a hole in the other side, they went up on the roof, back down through the other hole, and three guys stabbed him like 45 times in the face, you know, in front. Now, inside that cell, I want to explain that. In that prison in those days, cells were these big communal things. There weren't like a cell where you got two or three guys. You got like 50 guys in a cell. So like 50 guys are in that cell, and when the police come and investigate, nobody saw nothing. You know, nobody wants to be involved. So they murdered this guy, and Omar collected his $25,000. And interestingly enough, he was murdered the other day in Costa Rica, I heard.
Bill says during his time at the David Public Prison, he would continue to try and better himself and think of others, and talks about one occasion where he took it upon himself to save a number of very sick inmates.
I had a cell of like 20 tuberculosis guys who had tuberculosis, and we cured them. We actually, with the help of some ladies from the United States, we purchased medicine and I injected them every day. I was so afraid I was going to get tuberculosis. I put the mask on my face and gloves on my hands, and I would inject them with these really high-powered antibiotics every day and cured all. Only one of them died. Only one of them died, which was a sad thing, but still, it was really a cool thing I did that. I organized sports teams. I stopped the killings completely. When I took over, when I was firmly in control of the prison there, for 5 years, we didn't have one homicide. And there was five homicides a day. So my flirtation with Christianity began back in those days. I really began praying to God, who I very much believe in today.
The David Public Prison would soon be closed as a new supposed state-of-the-art facility was built at a cost of $15 million. Bill says he and the other inmates were actually quite excited to be relocated from what was an extremely dilapidated facility that was overcrowded with terrible conditions. However, he says from the very beginning, everything would fall apart.
And it was supposed to be a state-of-the-art facility designed by the Americans, they said. It cost $15 million to build. So they transferred us to this new prison. And the new prison was a completely different setup than the old one. The old one was just a ramshackle-type shithole. These were actually freestanding. Every cell block was freestanding. Held 125 men. It had 25 cells. Each cell block had 25 cells with five beds in it. And we were, and this time we were about 1,100 men. From the first day, we were overpopulated. Today, that same facility that had, that was created, that had 950 man capacity, has 1,800 people. So it's exactly almost double capacity. But back in those days, it wasn't terribly crowded. The cell blocks were huge. I mean, they were like, we're not used to having so much free space. And so that was nice. But what happened was they didn't plan for the consumption of water correctly. They drastically underplanned for how much water was going to be necessary to run a facility like that. 3 days into the being in the new facility, the water system collapsed. And when I say collapsed, I mean it fucking collapsed completely, no water. The tanks were dry. And so that from that day, from the third day of being in that new facility, water rationing began.
Of course, without proper infrastructure for water, it wouldn't take long for the prison's sewage system to become an issue. Bill says that the human waste found its way everywhere, with prisoners having to get creative with how they conducted their business.
You're in a cell with five or maybe six guys. Maybe there's one guy sleeping on the floor. And they give you water for 45 minutes one time a day. But what if you have to shit later? What you had to do is you had to make a capacho. A capacho is a little brown bird that sleeps in the grass in Panama. What an actual capacho is. And we called these packages of shit capachos because obviously they were brown. You took a piece of newspaper, doubled it. You used to squat over it, put it in the floor of the shower, squat over it, shit on it, roll it up, put it in a plastic bag and throw it out the window. That was how you shit. And just today, even today, that's how the people in the new Chiriqui Public Prison have to shit. This is a facility that costs $15 million, and you have to shit in a bag and throw it out the window.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It would be left up to the inmates at the facility to try and clean up the human waste, but to really no avail. They were fighting a losing battle. With conditions becoming increasingly worse and hazardous, Bill says he began to contact human rights organisations around the world, much to the government's anger. It would be while he was in the process of doing this that a large newspaper from the UK would get in touch. And unbeknownst to him, this would make the situation for Bill so much worse.
So I brought in human rights organizations, and a lady from the United Kingdom's Daily Mirror called me and said she wanted to do an interview. And they told me, the lady that was interviewing me told me, the interview was about the human rights conditions inside the prison. That's what they were going to do. They were going to do a human rights expose on Panama. So I started talking to her, and she does this interview with me. And I said, listen, I don't want to be on camera. I don't want you to quote me as being the source. And she said, no problem. She said, but I have to call you on a video phone call. I have to call you on a video phone call so that I know it's really you. You have to show me that it's really you. And I'm like, yeah, but the video phone call can't come out in the interview. And she said, no, never, never, never. And I said, I'll tell you intimate things about prison here, but you can't use my name. And she said, don't worry, I won't use your name, and the video phone call won't come out. What did they do? They made an expose about Wild Bill living like a fucking rock star inside prison. They didn't say anything about human rights at all, or just a little blurb in the article about it, but they made the article about me. And she didn't record my interview with her and post the video. She had a person standing beside her recording her talking to me. You could see my face talking, and you could see her doing the interview on the cell phone. Like, she's holding the cell phone, looking at it. I'm on the cell phone, and the guy standing to the side recording it. I can't see him because he's outside of the view of the camera or the telephone, and she published it. Sophie Evans was her name. So what happened to me? Holy shit in a handbag. The Panamanian authorities came down on me like a ton of bricks. They tried to transfer me to this terrible place called Sector C. I fought tooth and nail. I even got a judge's order saying that they couldn't send me there. I thought I was safe. I thought I'd beaten them. They started trying to transfer me there in January of 2019. This was 2019. I arrived at the new prison, at the Cherokee facility, at the new prison in September of 2017, and the interview that I did was in like December of 2018, and the Panamanian prison officials, look at what happened was the Panamanian news media picked up the story, and it blew up inside Panama that Panama had poor prisoners picking up shit. And it's true. I didn't tell anything it wasn't true. It was all the truth. And I talked about the guns in prison and how the cops sell guns and shit like that. But the government, instead of trying to fix the problem, the government punished me for telling about it. So anyway, so in January, they tried to get a judge's order to transfer me. The judge said, no, he hasn't done anything wrong. He hasn't broken any rules. You can't transfer him. They tried again in like May. Judge again said no. And said, final ruling, now it's been too much time. You can't bring this back up again. But the minister of security was a guy named Mirones. And Mirones signed an executive order from the president that I had to be transferred to dreaded Sector C.
So, unbeknownst to Bill, his life is about to be flipped upside down. As he lays sleeping in his cell at 4 a.m, the door flies open. As he looks up, he's grabbed by his hair and pulled from his bunk. 4 men jump on him, shackle him, and he is carried out to a waiting prison van where he's thrown inside and driven off to the dreaded Sector C.
The first time I ever heard about dreaded Sector C was when a guy named Gonzalo Atonairan, a friend of mine who went by the name Toulon, when Toulon got sent there after having received a lengthy sentence and the rumor was going around that he was going to try to escape. And this was back in the old prison. It's in the center of a 15,000 prisoner complex called La Jolla. There's 3 prisons inside, La Jolla, La Nueva Jolla, and La Joyita. I was in, originally, La Joyita, the first year of my prison experience. And then, as I said, in October 22nd, 2019, I got sent to La Nueva Jolla, Sector C. But Sector C is another thing. And so Gutierrez told us all, we're all sitting around like kids at a campfire roasting marshmallows, you know, sitting around his desk listening to him talk about this new prison that, like, where they suspend human rights and they really mistreat the prisoners and it's run by the national police. And I didn't believe him. I didn't believe him. It didn't seem realistic to me. And then when I got sent there, I found out that he wasn't talking a half of it, man. So this is how it happened. I was received there. I come inside. I'm handcuffed with my hands only. They immediately come and shackle my hands to my belt and my feet to my together and to my hands. So I'm like, you take baby steps when you move. Ching, 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 ching. So ching, 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 ching. I'm moving along. I'm like, something ain't right here, you know. So they bring me down and they're like, why don't you have a yellow shirt on? I'm like, I don't even own a yellow shirt. And so they made me completely undress myself and gave me a raggedy-ass pair of shorts that somebody else had been using and a yellow shirt that had a big hole in it. It was like somebody else had thrown away. And they took every single thing I had, all my possessions, toothbrush, toothpaste, photographs of people that I love, letters that my grandmother wrote. They took it all in front of me and threw it in the garbage. I had about $200 on my person. The 2 guards that were searching me took the money out, counted it, separated it between them, and put it in their fucking wallet in front of me. I immediately knew I'm in deep shit.
Life is about to begin for Bill in his new home of Sector C. He's taken down to a dark and stuffy room that's reserved for visiting hours. Visiting hours that never take place. As he sits there, in walks Police Commissioner Ortiz, and he and the Major, who is also in the room, begin a discussion on just how long Bill might remain alive in Sector C.
He says, "How long do you think he'll survive with those monsters from Cologne?" And the other one says, "I don't know, probably pretty long. He's pretty tough." And he's like, "Nah, they'll kill him inside a week." And I said something like, "Hey, man, I'm right here." And they're like, "Shut the fuck up. Nobody's speaking to you." And I'm like, fuck, I'm in a bad place. So they march me down, and they put me in a cell block. It's a huge cell block. The cell block's big, and it's one man to a cell. Everybody has a solitary cell, and they put me in a cell block. And they only let 4 or 5 guys out at a time for exercise every day. But when you first come in, they give you 15 days closed in. You're in 15 days on lockdown. The idea is that people will get used to you and not murder you when you come out. So, and like, it's going through the cell block that I'm there. Now listen, I want you to understand, Panamanian prisons are not segregated by race like American prisoners. Race is not an issue of any kind in Panama. Racism, as it is known, doesn't exist in the Republic of Panama. I personally believe that racism is something manufactured by the American government and the United Kingdom. I don't think it actually exists. I think it's bullshit. Now, somebody else might say differently. Somebody that's not from a white middle-class family might say something different. But I mean, I'm experiencing the Republic of Panama, and I'm telling you, it doesn't make a fuck what color you are, doesn't make a fuck where you're from. You're treated by how you treat other people, not by what color you are, not by where you're from. But this particular cell block was run completely by a gang called Calor Calor, and they are all black fellows. You have to be black to be part of the gang. And they put me, Lily White Boy, in with 16 Calor Calor black members. So the first thing that happens is two men, Zuko Zuko and Titi, that was their names. Zuko Zuko, that means like sugar, sugar. And Titi's, I don't know what, it doesn't mean anything. It just means since his name's Titi. Titi's like 6'8", weighs 250 pounds, not a single ounce of fat on him, and looks like the Incredible Hulk. And then Zuko Zuko is his exact opposite. He's skinny, rail thin, cheeky, little bitty, chiquitito, they say. He's chiquitito. He's very little and looks like a crackhead. They come to the door and they're like, "Hey, you got to give us money or we're going to kill you." I'm like, "I ain't giving nobody any money. I don't have any money. They took everything that I had away." I'm like, "No, but you can send money on the outside. You can send money on the outside to our family. You got to give us money. We're going to kill you." I'm like, "Well, then you're going to have to kill me because I ain't giving you no money." The guards are watching this because there's lots of guards in these. There are no guards in the up, but in Sector C now, there's lots of guards. So the guards are in the fishbowl. They're watching this happen, watching them threaten me. They think it's funny. They kill you in Sector C. That's what it's for. Sector C is so that they will kill you. The fatality rate in Sector C is 8% per year. That means for every 100 prisoners that are there, 8 of them die. Every year you're there, it doubles. 16%, 32%. You know, the longer you're there, the higher the chance are they're going to murder you.
He remains in his cell for 15 days. Every single day, approached by Titi and Zuko Zuko, taunting him and trying to extort him for money, threatening him with death if he doesn't pay. The countdown is on until one day, time is up. And a guard comes to open his cell.
I'm like, "I'm afraid." I ain't responded to nothing they said either. I haven't even responded. I was quiet. Like, they come by the cell and I would go, the cell, each cell has a shower. I would go sit in the shower while we're there. And like, I literally prayed. I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe I'm going to die. I haven't spoken to my family, you know, and so like, I'm in this hell. So I come out and I remember praying and God said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "David and Goliath." That's what God said. And I'm like, "What?" Like I'm not insane. God doesn't speak to me like I'm speaking to you, but in my heart, the words David and Goliath went over and over and over and over and over again. I come out of the cell, and there they are, and so both standing there, both of them got a knife in the hand. And so they come over and say, "Well, so are you going to give us the money or what?" And I said, "I ain't giving nobody nothing." And they start laughing, and the little one's like, "I'm going to kill you." And so I learned martial arts inside prison. I learned them in prison. And I boxed in the old prison. And so I put one foot in front of the other and put my hands up and said, "Let's go." The skinny one just walks like nothing's going to happen, walks over to me, and I hit him in the jaw. And I hit him harder than I've ever hit another human being in the entirety of my life. And everybody in the cell block was watching, and everybody heard his jaw broke. It broke, sounded like a shotgun. Kow! He hit the floor, and the shank that he had in his hand, the homemade knife that he had in his hand, bounced off the floor. He hit the floor, and he screamed a blood-curdling scream and grabbed his face, and blood was pouring out of his mouth. And I reached down and picked up the other knife, and I said to the big one, I said to TD, next! And from a room up top, a big voice sounded from a room and said, hey, Wild Bill, come on up here. And TT put his shank back in his waistband. He put his shank back in his waistband and walked away. So I walked up the steps and kind of stuck my head in the door and looked inside the cell. And there was a guy in that cell named Ali Ceballos. And he was the ruler of that group of Calor Calor. He was the boss. And he stuck a hand out at me, and he said, they call you Salvaje Bill, they call you Wild Bill. You are Wild Bill, man. And I'm like, no, dude, brother, I'm scared shitless. I told him, I'm scared to death. I'm just trying to survive. And he's like, man, ain't nobody going to bother you again here. He's like, you're my brother. I want to be your brother. And I said, fucking hell. You know, I'm really thankful that you do, man. And so we became friends. Ali Ceballos went free. Went to the street, was in the street 8 days, and they killed him. They shot him and his girlfriend to death in a car, and I cried like a baby when that happened because I was so distraught that my friend, who I spent time with in there in prison for, maybe he was there 6 months with me. We became very close, and he was especially special to me because I shouldn't have been allowed to live there with those guys. They were Afro-Caribe gangsters, man. They're like the big-time black gangsters.
So while Bill is safe for now, however, it isn't long before he sees just how dangerous and easy it is to take a life in Sector C.
My friend Tercero was killed. He was a big-time gangster, and he was in a cell block that was, all the people in that cell block were with him. You know, his group, his tropa, his gang. But somebody was offering $50,000 for his life on the outside. So what two guys from the group of Baghdad did, Baghdad's group, that's another gang on the outside, biggest, most violent, crazy gang in Panama. But it's a huge organization and very military. It's the best organized gang. Two guys did like a Mission Impossible thing. They climbed up onto the roof, out of the roof, climbed down. I mean, we're talking three stories high. Climbed back down inside that patio, inside that cell block, and right when they were getting ready to climb, check this out. Right when they were getting ready to climb inside the cell block, men in their cell block took two wires and stuck them in the electrical outlet. But like made a short on purpose so that the breakers in the building would flip. When the breakers in the building flip, the cops can't open the doors. They have to call somebody from the outside to come and turn the breakers back on before the doors, because the cops, where the cops are stationed, the door is an electric door, and that's the only way it'll open. It doesn't have a key. It has to be opened by electricity. You have to push the button and it beep, beep, click, click, and it opens, you know? So they shorted out the electrical system so that the cops couldn't come in, and the two guys came down, zip down bedsheet ropes, and stabbed Tercero 100 times to death. And what you might ask yourself, what happened to the two guys that stabbed him to death? The guys who are in their cells are watching this, are part of Tercero's gang, but they can't do anything because they're locked in their cells. And the only one that happened to be in the cell block at that moment was Tercero. And so, like, the other guys are watching, they're screaming obscenities and throwing rocks and shit, but they can't do anything because the two guys are loose inside the cell block. They literally just sat down in the door and wait for the cops to come and pick them up. The cops come and pick them up, take them back to the cell blocks. Now they got another homicide charge, and the shit continues.
So he was getting by. He still had his communication with the outside world due to having a cell phone, and he was able to still buy himself the odd creature comfort. But that would all change the day another prisoner would make national headlines.
A man named Gilberto Ventura did the absolutely impossible. He escaped from Sector C. Fucking Jason Bourne couldn't do what he did. I'm not joking. I mean, like, fucking insanity. He escaped from Sector C, and when that happened, the police came down on Sector C like a thundering ton of bricks. They come, and everybody in Sector C hid and still does, hides their contraband in the doors. You cut a hole in the door with a piece of hacksaw blade, and that takes a long time to do because the metal is very thick. It takes about 7 days working 8 hours a day to do this. You cut a hole in the door and you use that hole to hide your cell phone, or if you have a gun, or if you have a big knife or something, you use that. Well, this guy escaped, and when he did, the cops know where you hide your stuff. They just don't give a shit. But because they know that the guns and stuff we used to kill each other. We don't kill police with those. But when that happened, the police came down on us like a ton of bricks, and they came with a torch and cut holes in the doors and took everybody's contraband. I lost my phone. Now, a phone in Sector C, a telephone in Sector C, costs $3,000 US, a telephone, a cellular phone, smartphone. And so I lost mine, and I hadn't had any money come in for about 5 months, and I became a ghost. I disappeared from the world. I became a man who no longer existed. My cute little Panamanian wife left me high and dry. She ran away with another American. Imagine that. And well, my whole life was just shattered.
Bill is done. He has nothing left. No access to any funds, no communication with anyone on the outside. And many will say he's finally serving a sentence the way it should be done. Uncomfortable punishment. However, Bill says that in the infamous Sector C, communication with the outside world is vital, not just to be able to speak with people, but to get access to necessities that help keep you alive.
In Sector C, it's so hard to live. If you get sick, you fucking die. They don't take you to the doctor in Sector C. If you can't eat the food, you fucking die. If you are attacked by other prisoners, you fucking die. That's it. It's hell. The only thing I had in the world was a couple changes of clothes and a Bible. I began reading that Bible. This is February 2020. I began reading that Bible. And Jerry, this crazy guy who came in from another prison, began preaching. And like one day he would preach and the next day he would be drunk. And then one day he would preach, and the next day he'd be all stoned or high, smoking crack. Or, you know, he was worthless. He wasn't really a very good preacher. And nobody listened to him either. And so I prayed to God, and I asked God, what do I do? I'm lost. And I asked God to kill me. I asked him. I begged him to kill me. I said, please, God, kill me. And my friend had a pistol, a friend of mine, a small Argentine snub-nosed revolver. And I took it up to my cell, and I literally put it in my mouth, and I just couldn't find the courage to pull the trigger. I wanted to die. I wanted to die. And I did not kill myself because, like, it's the noble thing to do to not do this. I didn't kill myself because I didn't have the fucking balls. And I was afraid of what would happen after the bullet passes through my brain. Like, what's going to happen on the other side, you know? And I haven't lived a very good life. And am I going to hell? So I didn't kill myself. And that's why. And I tried twice. And so I prayed to God and I asked God to kill me. And God said, no, I'm going to use you. And I said, what? And he said, you're going to preach my word. And I said, you're out of your mind. This is a conversation in my heart that I'm having with God. I said, you're out of your mind. And God said, I made the universe and everything in it, and I made you, and you ain't trash. I make things that are useful. You're useful to me. You're going to preach my word. And I said, no. And God said, I want you to go to church. The next time Jerry starts to preach, I want you to go out there and I want you to sit with him and try to help him. And I'm like, fuck, I don't want to do that. And this went back and forth for like 3 days. And then so the next time Jerry was scheduled to preach was Monday. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 8 o'clock in the morning. So Monday at 8 o'clock in the morning, I got up and I went and sat at the table with Jerry. And everybody laughed and made fun of me, you know. And I sat Jerry, and Jerry's crazy ass is preaching something that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's like difficult to follow. So I decided I would help Jerry because I sing. And so I told Jerry, I said, I want to sing before you preach. And he like didn't want me to. So I sang. I sang like 3 hymns in Spanish that I know. And like everybody was in the doors looking now. Now everybody's spending, and now Jerry's happy because like everybody's listening to him and nobody normally listens to him. And so then he asked me, would you sing again? And I said, yeah. And so this goes on for like a couple of weeks. I even gave what's called a lectura, which is like I read a Bible verse and say a 2-minute thing about what I think about the Bible verse. And then he starts preaching and he talks and talks for like 2 fucking hours, like just rambling madness.
For a few weeks, this odd couple of a singing former hitman and a drunk preacher are giving the weekly church services. Until one day, the preacher would quit unexpectedly when he has a run-in with another prisoner.
So I was sitting in my room, and there's a kid called Mata Policia. It means killed, means cop killer. So cop killer is a kid. He's like 23 years old. He's this big, mean kid, like really a mean kid. So Mata Policia kicks Jerry the preacher in the ass. He like kicks him hard enough to like lift him up off the floor. I'm in the cell. I didn't know that was happening. My cell's open. I'm in the cell. Preacher Jerry comes running into my cell, and he says, "Hey, Bill, give me a knife." And I said, "Right there on the shelf, there's a little knife." And it's like something I use to peel oranges, you know? And it was a little bitty thing, like maybe an inch long. It's not something, they wouldn't even take that in a search. In a police search, they wouldn't even take it. They would leave it laying there. And he's like, no, man, a fucking shank to kill somebody. And I'm like, Jerry, you're the pastor of the church. What do you need a shank for? I don't even have one. I don't even have one. And he says, "I'm going to kill Mata Policia." And I said, "What? You're the pastor of the church, Jerry. You're supposed to be our preacher. How are you going to kill somebody? What the fuck are you talking about?" And he's like, "Fuck the church." And I'm like, "What did you say? Don't say," I'm like, "It hurts my ears. Like, don't, oh God, don't say that." And he's like, "Fuck the church. I'm not the pastor of the church. I'm going to kill Mata Policia." I'm like, "Why?" He's like, "He disrespected me in front of everybody." I'm like, "What did he do?" He didn't want to tell me. He didn't want to tell me that he kicked him in the ass. And somebody else walks by the door, and he's like, "He kicked him in the ass, man." And I'm like, "Jesus, Jerry." It's like they hit Jesus in the face, and they slap Jesus, and they spit on Jesus, you know? You're just going to have to take it. That's part of the thing, man. You're supposed to be an instrument of peace. He's like, "Fuck you and fuck the church. Now you're the pastor." I'm like, "No, I am not the pastor. I didn't want to be. I don't." And he's like, "No, you're the pastor of the church." And so he leaves. And so I thought, Jerry's pissed off. I'll talk to him Monday. Everything will be fine. Monday comes around. He ain't going to church. And he's drunk as shit in his cell. So I went to church, sang a couple songs, read a Bible verse. And like it was like 15 minutes was over. And I was terrible.
So begins Bill's journey as the new preacher of Sector C. He says he takes his new role extremely seriously and works at getting better as a preacher. He would continue to give the weekly church service and would in fact enlist the help of other inmates, including a former preacher from the outside. As COVID would hit the world with so much uncertainty, Bill says that more and more inmates begin to attend the services. So many, in fact, that Bill begins to enlist other inmates to begin helping take services. Now, of course, a lot is said about people who find God when in prison. This apparent miraculous transformation of a once bad person who suddenly sees the light. Let's just say not many buy into it. And Bill says he would like to address that.
People make fun of us when we join the church or when we try to do something good on the inside. They make fun of us because we're murderers. But you know what? Listen, I want you to listen to me really carefully. We're trying to do something right with our lives. We're trying to change and be better for our lives. Instead of laughing at us, instead of trying to make light of what we're doing, you need a guy like me on the inside trying to convert young men who are going to go free again so that when they get out on the outside, they don't go back to killing and robbing and stealing again. Because them's the same motherfuckers that are going to break in your house. But maybe if he has his encounter with Jesus Christ, with Wild Bill, trying to help him, maybe when he gets out, he'll go get a job. And there are not just me. There's lots of guys like me on the inside that are doing that too. In the Republic of Panama, there's probably 50 guys doing what I'm doing right now in a prison population of 20,000. In the United States, there's probably 50,000 guys doing that on the inside. I mean, these are important guys. Our job's important because the government ain't rehabilitating nobody. You know it. We know it. The government programs don't rehabilitate nobody. And so if you want to really change your life, you're going to have to do it through a guy like me. So that's my case for why it's important. Religion in prison is important. The government needs people like me in a prison system with an 87% reoffend rate within 1 year. A prison system like that needs a guy like me.
Bill continued his work as the pastor, and he says a large portion of that was helping youngsters stay away from the gangs or in fact leave the gangs in which they had grown up in, as well as helping those addicted to drugs to wean themselves off. He says things were going so well that even a number of police commissioners actively helped him with the work he was doing. And in fact, a commissioner by the name of Darwin would approach the authorities on Bill's behalf to have him removed from Sector C.
After I had been in there for a long time, he worked with the government and called the penitentiary system and said, "Hey, look, Bill is doing a really good job. He's doing something really needed, and he wants to carry what he's doing on over to the prisons to change people's lives, and I believe in him. And so he did this for me. It's really incredible that a police commissioner would do this for a murderer. I'm thankful to him. Anyway, so the police, the national prison system sent a paper on the 24th of July saying that I could go anywhere inside this prison that I wanted to, any other sector. Remember, Sector C is only one sector inside the prison. There's Sector A, Sector E, Sector B, and Sector D. Now, the foreigners, people who are not Panamanians, are all in Sector E. And so I asked, and it's a minimum security environment, I asked to be sent to the foreigners area. And they, I don't know, the warden lady, there's over Sector C, the warden is the police commissioner. But over all the other sectors, the warden is a woman named Linda Moreira.
The prison warden would not only deny Bill's request, but he says she would send him to an extreme security sector, which is where he remains today.
They came back and got me and took me out, researched all my stuff, and they put me in an extreme security, extreme, that's more than maximum. I was in maximum. They put me in extreme security with the gang Baghdad. Calor Calor and Baghdad are at war. I don't know if you understand the significance of this. Imagine in California, you may have heard of the Bloods and the Crips. Imagine a Blood being put in a cell block with nothing else but Crips. Now, I've lived 4 years with Calor Calor. I'm identified with that gang, even though I'm no part of it. But I'm identified with them, and they come and stick me in Baghdad. She's trying to kill me. Not only did they do that, they put me in a cell block in punishment. I'm in the hole. They put me in a place that they put you if you try to escape or something. If you try to escape or you shoot a cop, that's where they put you. That's where they've got me right now. That's where I'm at right now, recording this.
Most people will listen to this and say that Bill is exactly where he should be. And you might be right. Bill killed people. He took the lives of others. And for that, he most certainly should be punished. However, he would like to have one last word on the matter.
I'm a bad guy. I'm being honest with you. I was a bad guy. I killed people in the street. I've got a 46-year homicide sentence. I'm serving it. But for the last 5 years, I've done what's right. And I'm going to continue doing that for the rest of my life. And I believe wholeheartedly that if I look for good things are going to follow into place. And every day of my life, I look to be compassionate to young men who have nobody that cares about them. What I'm doing and my ministry does on the inside is show young men that they don't need a gang in order to survive, that they can find the skills necessary to support themselves not being in a gang. Now, you'd think that the government would want that. You'd be wrong. Damn wrong. They don't want nothing to do with me, and not only that, they don't want me helping anybody else. And that's not all the government. For instance, Darwin Morales, the police commissioner that he understood what I'm trying to do. But I need you guys out there. I need your help. I'm not asking you guys for money, but I'm asking you, if you know somebody, a lawyer, a human rights attorney, a human rights organization that does pro bono work that would like to help me. It's not like I'm asking you for sympathy. I'm not asking anybody to have sympathy for me. I'm not asking anybody to help me get out of jail. I'm asking someone to help me get my situation rectified where I can continue to help the other prisoners. Because that's what I want to do with my life. And I believe that if I do that, then God will one day let me out of prison.
You have 1 minute remaining.
These episodes were in no way designed to try and garner sympathy for William Dathan Hulbert. Bill is a man who has done terrible things. However, he says he's also a man who has changed his ways and wants to spend the rest of his days helping others. Whether you believe him or not is up to you. 1 Minute Remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production, created, hosted, and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of Earsay.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.